Welcome to Mental Wealth, Barriers and Stigmas in Our Society. We're your hosts. I'm Madeline.
And I'm Alexis.
We are both fresh to the field of mental health as licensed rec therapists. And for those of you who do not know what recreational therapy is, why don't you explain to them what it is,
Alexis? Thank you, Madeline. I feel like the more I get into rec therapy, the more I question what isn't rec therapy. Just all the things that Madeline and I have gotten to experience over the past couple years has been transformational, just the way that we look at healthcare. Recreational therapy is when a licensed and certified professional utilizes recreation and leisure interventions. We support those by evidence-based practices that fosters the physical, emotional, cognitive, social, and spiritual growth of persons of all ability levels.
Yeah, and the number one, not number one, the one a big aspect of, I think, rec therapy that is slowly starting to spread is this, like, information of growth of, like, not just the whole leisure education, but just the importance of talking about mental health specifically. And that is a point of our podcast. This podcast specifically, we're going to talk about schizophrenia. Why, Alexis? What did we do the past 3 months?
The past couple months, we've been doing some intensive research on schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders and what a recreational therapist can do for a person with schizophrenia. And all the episodes that are going to follow this, we'll keep talking more about mental wealth, and we're also going to introduce you to a new diagnosis out of the DSM-5, and we'll introduce you to that in a little bit. But yeah, every episode you'll get an introduction to a different mental illness, and our whole goal is really just to break the barriers that are between us and talking about mental health.
Let's get it. So today on this episode of Mental Wealth, Barriers and Stigmas in Our Society, since it is our first episode, we are going to give you all a brief history into the mental health world. We are going to kind of break into the multiple groups of barriers that we're going to kind of scratch the surface on and give you all an explanation of kind of what is DSM-5, what you can find in DSM-5, and then obviously specifically dive into schizophrenia in itself and all the pharmacology and research-based interventions that we've kind of been working on for the past few months. So I'll let Alexis take it away on the history. So to start us off, I mean, mental illness has had a extremely rough start. Just, I mean, not even that long ago, back in the 1960s and 1970s, mental illness was defined by the diagnosis alone, was really put into really specific categories, and was not thought of as this holistic kind of like ever-changing disease. But where now we're kind of moving towards this terminology of mental health, which is more based on the wellness model and includes like various indicators such as life satisfaction, purpose, personal growth, environmental mastery, self-acceptance, all of that, that kind of follows similar models of the rec therapy, which, you know, hits on the social, cognitive, intellect, physical, many things that can dive into and affect your mental health. And that is understandable of why it's been so hard to kind of wrap our heads around not just mental health itself, but then, you know, the everything that comes with it, the barriers, all of the social stigmas, and it's hard to discuss that as a society.
That's awesome. I love that you highlighted the difference between, you know, what is mental illness and what is mental health. And it's crazy to just see our viewpoints on both of these as time has progressed and as more research is getting out there, people are getting more educated, people are starting to talk more. And it's crazy. Both my parents grew up in the 60s, and talking about mental health and mental illnesses with them isn't a thing. Talking with them, they said as they grew up, you didn't talk about mental health, you didn't talk about your emotions. And so even, trying to speak with them about it now, it is still a very hush-hush thing. So this is a huge barrier. And the word mental illness in itself, that is a barrier. And who put it there? And I think we did, truthfully. I think we did as a society. I was reading an article not too long ago, and a quote I pulled from the article, and this was just someone's personal opinion, but he stated that mental illness was one of the most deeply discrediting and socially damaging of all stigmas. And I, reading that and reading it 10 times over, it sounds more absurd every time. And there's global programs that are trying to fight this mental health stigma. And I think we're making progress, but it is a small dent in a very large hole I think we need to make through this wall that we have, this barrier between us and mental health, and just talking about it and getting people educated. And
yeah,
I think the biggest question is how do we end it, or where do we start? I think it's important anytime you're learning new information, new topic, anything like that. It's important to learn where you came from. And so, like, looking back on mental illness and seeing the course, I've done a lot of reading recently on mental health. Just a short novel. It's called 10 Days in a Madhouse by Nellie Bly. I guarantee it for anyone who's interested in mental illness or just to see the course of it. The story is about a woman. She's actually a journalist. She checks herself into an insane asylum, and she has to go through a whole process in itself to fake that she is insane for the courts to get her in there. And
what time of year is this going on? Like last year?
Twenties. Yeah, no. This is definitely an older novel. This woman, Nellie, she checks herself in, and she describes the treatment that she received, the things that she saw in there, and it's almost heart wrenching to think that actual human. This is a real novel. It's based on a true story. Just as far as like not receiving like rations of food during the day and freezing temperatures, they hardly have any clothing. They're doing all like the housekeeping work around this insane asylum, and it's crazy. But throughout the story, there's always it seems one person in Nellie's corner, and one person that stuck out in particular to me. Her name was Miss Kane, and I felt like she was just like a true advocate for Nellie. She comforted her through this her whole process, and even though she was only in there for 10 days, like reading this story, it felt like she was in there for years. And I'm sure that's how it felt for her, especially checking herself in, knowing that she was sane. And she actually encountered a lot of other people in there who were sane, and they just, because of the court systems, they just didn't have a choice. They were checked in there. And I was just thinking, and I was like, who does Miss Kane remind me of? And I was thinking this whole time, like, what if Miss Kane is that recreational therapist? She's that constant figure in somebody's corner. And I think that's a way we can look at rec therapy, where our clients' biggest cheerleaders. They feel extremely comfortable with us based on our therapeutic relationships that we establish.
And constantly needing to advocate for them and making sure that, they're getting the best possible care that they can. Especially, I feel like, in the mental health realm, that's huge.
No, absolutely. And just, like, looking back, like, just the lack of justice that was, in the court systems, what people were experiencing in the asylums. And I know we've touched on this a lot, Madeline and I have, in the past couple of months, of just, like, what equality looks like. And looking back on this and seeing that there was never a equality in mental health, looking at different ethnicities and cultures that Nellie encountered within the asylum, they were treated more poorly. By the sounds of it, the women were also treated more poorly. There's just there's a ton of advocacy here, and it's just like that constant reminder that the rec therapist, they are the person that's in your corner. You know, it's bizarre with all of these advocates that we have in our corner, it's still so hard to talk about mental health.
And why is it so hard to talk about mental health? I think what we've kind of come down to is that it's overall just a lack of experience / overall knowledge of mental health in itself, that it's not like a physical disease. It's not, you know, an injury that you can put a bandage on or take a medication or do a surgery about to fix. It's complicated. It's dynamic. There's so many social and lifestyle choices that can go into it. And overall, I mean, it's an imbalance of chemicals in the brain that you can't just take a scan of to decide what's wrong with you or what's, you know, what you need to be working towards. So it's hard to make a diagnosis, let alone then, you know, figuring out prescriptions and all of that that goes into treating someone.
Yeah, sort of like the treatment course you take after that. And I think another, you know, just another hard thing about mental health is how vastly different it looks for everyone. You know, something that I choose to foster my well-being, like going to CrossFit for the day, and Madeline, you might go skiing on the hill. You know, what someone does to, you know, foster their well-being and really work on their mental health is it's just different. And I even think when two people receiving the same diagnosis, even that looks extremely different. You know, people have different different symptoms. They portray different characteristics. And I think that's what makes this entire topic extremely difficult, is because there isn't one right answer. And I know when I'm looking at different mental illnesses, and I still struggle with trying to keep a lot of them apart, because they're, you know, some of them all, you know, they look the same to me, but I like to turn to the DSM-5 to kind of point me in the right direction.
And the DSM-5, for those of you who are unaware, is the fifth edition of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, which was put out by the Psychiatric Association, and pretty much is for all clinical employees who need, you know, reference. It's kind of gives this more standardized procedure of, here are the symptoms, here is how long this person needs to have them to be diagnosed with this, and then, you know, what next, what are the interventions, what are some of the common symptoms that come with this. And it also, not just to list these symptoms, but also, yeah, explains what are these symptoms, what do hallucinations involve, what do what is disorganized speech, what is the common factors that go into that.
You know, so why the DSM-5? Why is a recreational therapist I would use it, the DSM-5? And it helps to create protocols that really help me lay the foundation for the programs that I'm going to be providing for my clients. You know, to understand, to create these programs, I first have to learn about a person's diagnosis and then see in real life how this client functions with that diagnosis. Because like we said before, no two people or diagnosis looks the same. And, you know, educating myself, and for you out there listening, educating yourself on these diagnoses and learning people's worldviews, that's how we can start to break the barriers and become bigger advocates. And it really just starts with education and exposure. And I think the DSM-5 does a great job of this.
And adding to that, I mean, another huge part of understanding this, these various diseases, is the pharmacology of it all and all of the side effects that come along with it. And in order to create that diagnostic protocol, and in order to create this program and to truly understand who we are working with, it would be silly to just ignore all of this, these prescriptions that they will be taking, and maybe multiple of them, and, you know, the counter effects of them and the symptoms and just the overall, I mean, a lot of what it comes down to is just overall just being wiped out after taking various prescriptions. This also adds to the complexity of mental health in itself. I mean, and why I think a lot of people have a hard time wrapping their heads around, you know, why are they not taking their medication? Why aren't they just able to, you know, take a pill and, you know, feel better? Or, you know, are they taking too many pills? It's like, it's not that easy. We just have, just for fun, we just have a list of some of the various medications that
are... Have you seen the names on some of these? They're insane. I don't think I can pronounce even half
Let's
of them.
Let's hear some. Let's hear it.
Oh. where do I start? Trifluperazine.
Well, that one, yeah.
That was a tongue twister.
Preferesazine. Chlorpromazine. Florifenazine.
Acinpine.
And, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And one list, though, that is even longer than that are the side effects. Oh, my gosh. I mean, from rashes to fever, confusion, difficulty breathing, for females, breath, like, reducing the amount of breast milk production, breast enlargement. I mean, some of them counteract each other. It's like not being able to sleep too much, seizures. As a recreational therapist, it is so crucial to understand and be aware of all of these symptoms that are possible with your patients, and be able and be ready to adapt to the programs and understand that, you know, coping with these symptoms is a barrier in itself, and being understanding of your patients if they're feeling fatigued that day from, you know, the 90 symptoms they're going through, and figuring out their mix of pharmacology.
Yeah, I think even just like this discussion that we have here, like, and I'm sure for people listening in that, you know, just listening to that could have been overwhelming. Pharmacology is not easy to understand. It can be extremely complex, and again, it's different for every person. So really just understanding and interpreting that is a barrier in itself. And imagine a person just receiving a diagnosis and they're finally getting answers, and all of a sudden, you know, their life is changing, and then you have to go and you have to meet with another doctor who rambles off a list of medications like we poorly attempted here. And boom, it's just like another barrier goes up. And so, you know, we're creating these barriers within ourselves, and that can transpire to creating larger barriers that we're experiencing in our society. And I think that's why it's just so important that we educate ourselves and turn to resources like the DSM-5 and, you know, professionals like rec therapists, you know, like Madeline and I, like, we are the people that are in your corner.
So over the past few months, Alexis and I have been breaking down our own barriers, learning about schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders, coming from not much, you know, an abnormal psych class years ago, and not really having little to no experience with
working with people with schizophrenia, knowing someone with schizophrenia. We started from scratch here.
Yeah, and so for those who don't know what schizophrenia is or how to diagnose it, DSM exactly states it is defined by two or more of the following, each present for a significant portion of time during a 1 month period. At least one of these must be apparent: delusions, hallucinations, disorganized speech, grossly disorganized or catatonic behavior, and negative symptoms. So, and then it continues to go on, getting into really specifics, whether, you know, if it's affecting major areas such as work, interpersonal relations, or self-care. They make sure to include whether if that it is not considered schizophrenia if it is a other medical condition or a physiological effect from substances such as drugs or medications, and they ensure that it says it needs to be present for at least 1 month.
So, looking at, you know, us as rec therapists, what can we do for someone who has schizophrenia or another psychotic disorder? What will their course of treatment look like? And so we created this entire project based off of coping skills, and as a rec therapist, you know, utilizing recreation and leisure as our modalities, we're going to utilize leisure as a coping skill. And so leisure, I created a leisure participation program. It's a simple education program because those with schizophrenia typically aren't actively participating in leisure opportunities. So the goal of this education program was just to you have the clients write down all of the activities that they participated in previous to entering their treatment. And then we need to look at what were they doing and what can we provide for them here within the facility to get these people active again. And then it also gives them the chance to learn about other leisure opportunities that they might not have otherwise had access to. Maybe they didn't know about it or had a previous interest in it as well.
So another program that we decided to create was based on a symptom that isn't usually brought up with schizophrenia, but is a definitely kind of undercurrent common theme, is the inability to kind of cope with your emotions in a healthy manner. They have a big buildup of aggression and confusion, and especially being in a facility. So our program, this one focuses on actually identifying your emotions, and through not just maybe words, but through pictures and through more of an imagery kind of sense. There has been a lot of research to show that people with schizophrenia, with chronic schizophrenia or other psychotic disorders, through like visual imagery, that they've been able to increase cognitive abilities and functionality, reduce their symptoms of depression. I mean, there's just a lot of really positive side effects from this. So that was one of our programs that we created. But then after, you know, talking to different professionals, it was kind of a slap in the face that we were reminded that sometimes this program would be a little too much for someone with, you know, delusions and hallucinations, that being able to say, you know, here's a poster and cut out a bunch of pictures to talk about your feelings is way too complex of an idea, and or too simple of an idea. You know, there's a lot of feelings going on, and that was kind of a barrier in itself for you know, the participants, for the rec therapist. It's just a nice reminder to kind of slow down and like break down this kind of complex idea of being able to identify emotions. How do we deal with our emotions? And how do we make a program out of it?
Yeah, it was interesting. I feel like we got so far with this research, and we did this poster presentation, and when it finally got down, you know, to the nitty gritty, and to think, man, all of this work, you know, just because we learned about a diagnosis on a paper or on through research or a textbook, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean it's always going to work.
And to go back to that, some of that research, a lot of it was not just art therapy, not just, you know, leisure education, but a lot of it was, you know, intensive psychotherapy and therapist client interactions.
Right, and another huge thing in rec therapy is the importance of the relationship that you have between yourself and your clients. And I remember one of my clinical experiences, I had the opportunity to observe adolescents in an inpatient treatment facility, and there was one patient in particular who had kind of received, like, you know, he was received his own, you know, like, individualized stigma in there of just this bully kid. And I remember watching one time he was just having just a really bad day, and the rec there, and he was, you know, talking back to the rec therapist, and I'd never seen him act in this manner, usually super respectful. And he went out with the rec therapist, and, you know, all the boys were jumping around and, ooh, like, he's in trouble. And the kid who was, you know, quote unquote labeled as a bully, I watched him actually, like, break down and cry in front of the rec therapist. And for the first time, I was able to see this kid just really open up. And that was just a huge, like, learning opportunity for me to really see, like, rec therapists are some of the biggest advocates for mental health patients, and just the importance of this profession, and how great it looks to have how great it feels to have a rec therapist in your corner. And like we've said before, mental health just doesn't look the same for everyone. And tying it back into the 10 days in a madhouse when she had that advocate that was in her corner, you know, we are the Mrs. Kane in the corner.
And that, I mean, to go back to breaking down that barrier of, I mean, building that relationship, because that is not going to, I mean, you know, your art project or your, you know, volleyball activity is not going to matter if the patients don't respect you and you can actually build that, you know, that therapeutic relationship. And a big way of doing that, as Alexis has emphasized, is totally making sure they know that you're advocating for them.
And in rec therapy, we follow a systematic process. It's called the APRIDE process. Again, for those who aren't aware, it's assessment, planning, implementing, evaluation, and documentation. So we start off by meeting, when we meet our clients, we perform assessments. I know in my clinical experience, particularly the mental health one that I was just talking about, I was able to see a RASP and a leisure well-being assessment. So the rec therapist, they're sitting down with these clients when they're coming to their facility, or in whether inpatient, outpatient, community-based, any setting possible, and they're, you know, they're getting to know their clients on a deeper level. They're getting to know their interests, likes, dislikes, you know, what leisure experiences they're participating in, what they don't want to participate in. And this is really how you start to just build that therapeutic relationship. And even that in itself, you are breaking down barriers for that client that you are offering services to.
So to get back of, you know, why are we here? Why did we start this podcast? Just getting back to that idea of how do you advocate for just one person is breaking down that stigma and creating this, just increasing the knowledge and awareness of mental health as a whole and all of the pieces that go into it. You know, we gave you the DSM-5, there is extensive research about various topics. Another amazing resource is mentalhealthamerica.com. Goes into all spectrums and realms of mental health, specifically, you know, what to do next kind of thing. Not just, you know, here is your diagnosis, but then here is, you know, here are therapies, here are group discussions to go to, here are, you know, some just like community events where there are other people that may have this disorder.
No, absolutely. And just like, just going back to what she was, what Madeline was saying, you know, how do you advocate for just one person? How do you break down a barrier for just one person? And, you know, education is a huge piece. And I think it's also so important to define what does mental health look like for you? Start talking with your family and friends, coworkers, peers, anyone around you. What does mental health look like for people? And I think just to get the conversation going is also another great start.
Well, thank you so much for tuning in to our first episode. And we will catch you next week.
Woo!